And welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron here on August 22nd, 2013. www.thematthewaaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook by going to the search bar at the top of your screen and typing in the Matthew Aaron Show, and then you click like. You can also listen to us on Stitcher, iTunes, of course. You can subscribe and leave comments, Stitcher. You can listen to all sorts of your favorite podcasts and radio shows, and we are just one of them. And we're the best one of them. Let's see. We're on Instagram at Matt Aaron Show. You could see pictures from the show and everything going on. And today, we got a really good show. It is a show that involves a controversial yet really good independent film from this year called The Teacher, which is in theaters September, but is on video on demand now, and it has one of the best performances of the year, if not the best performance of the year, in Lindsay Burge, probably only to be compared with Brie Larson from Short Term 12. In the female category, and Will Britton, who's in it as well, and Will is a newcomer who's fantastic in this film, and Hannah Fidel is the director, and she did a fantastic job, and she wrote it as well, and we're going to talk to them. A lot of interesting things they talked about in this interview, and it's I feel this is one of the sharpest interviews I've done. It's funny. We talk about a lot of things that are, I don't think they talked about on their press tour. So let's play the A Teacher interview. And then when we come back, we're going to have Rudy Mick on. And Rudy Mick is, as I've talked about on yesterday's show, basically he is the professional kitchen nightmares for the real world, and you're gonna see why, and we're gonna listen to that next. And so here's the teacher interview with Hannah Fidel, Will Britton, and Lindsay Burge. Candy Crush. You play Candy Crush? Who plays Candy Crush? Any of you?
No, I played it.
So if I ask Will, if I ask you how to beat level 65, would you know? Or
I play it like on the toilet.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I play it on the toilet here. All right.
Gentlemen.
Oh, yes. Sorry. So, okay. Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am here with the cast and director of A Teacher. Breakout hit, South by Southwest, Sundance. That's exciting, right? Help me.
Fidel.
Why do I want to call you Fidel Castro?
Because
you look nothing like him.
Are you sure?
Well, no, nothing like. I think he has the same jean jacket. Honestly, I think he does have that jacket. But, no. Fidel. It's like Fidel.
Yeah.
Why am I getting all your names wrong when they're the easiest names ever? I'm imagining none of you listen to my show, because why would you? But I don't get anyone's names right ever. Like, Joe Swanberg yesterday, that was an easy one for me. And Lindsay, you've worked with Joe. And Lindsay Burge, that one's kind of, I got that one right.
Yeah, you got it. All right. You nailed it.
See, I'm from Chicago. We don't do names. And then Will spells his name odd for Britton. I mean, no, Will Britton, it's cool.
There's one more T. I don't know what's so odd about that.
Well, all right. It's got too many T's going for me. Too many T's, brother. It looks like Will Britain.
Yes.
But Britain sounds a little more like actorly, though, doesn't it? Like, Oscar-winning actorly.
I think,
right?
I think Britain sounds like multiple Oscar-winning actors.
You think? That sounds studio
different
to me,
categories.
Bro. That sounds Transformers 5 to me, bro.
No, I think
that's what Will wants. Sir.
Michael Bay's like, we need that Will Britton.
No Transformers 5 around here.
No Transformers 5?
Are you full of shit.
Yeah. You are so full of shit, it's not even funny.
Think twice before you say that.
Yeah. It hasn't been released yet.
That payday, you will never regret. Hannah, would you do Transformers 5 if they asked you? A fucking course you would.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just would like to say Bad Boys 1 and 2, favorite movies in my, well, Bad Boys 2 is in my top 5.
Have you listened to the director's commentary?
Yes, I have.
How amazing is it?
It's so good.
How amazing. Have you listened to his one for Armageddon?
Nope.
Okay, no, the director's commentary for Fight Club is pretty amazing.
No, no, we're talking about Michael Bay here. They, David Fincher's interesting and smart and intellectual. Michael Bay is insane.
Yeah.
Like, he's watching Bad Boys like he's watching Citizen Kane. And he's, like, picking it apart. He's like, you know, the shot where they go over, like, the Miami sign? And, like, it's this big, expensive shot in the movie. And Michael's like, of course we didn't have enough money to do this the way I wanted to do it. Spent half our budget on cocaine. Which I'm guessing you didn't for a teacher. You didn't spend half the budget on cocaine. What was the budget? In, like, give me a range here.
It wouldn't buy you very much cocaine.
It wouldn't buy you much cocaine? Bath salts? Could I get some bath salts with this money?
Probably not.
Wow.
Vodka.
Well, you know, Swanberg and I, we were talking yesterday about budgets because, of course, he's the Drinking Buddies, which is like a $1 million movie almost. It's a little under that, but everything before that, as Lindsay's well aware of, and you did give me the loot with Adam, everything before that's like 10 to 30 grand.
Sometimes less.
Wow. Right. I think Joe is being a little, you know, like how guys talk about their penises.
Right.
I think Joe's like, yeah, 10 grand most of the time. And so tell me about, give me a realistic range of what we're talking about for a teacher.
Oh.
Clerks?
What was Clerks?
Is Clerks fair? 30 grand? Is that fair?
No.
More?
It was a little more than that.
Okay.
But less than $1 million.
Okay. That doesn't help. That doesn't help me at all. I'm guessing it's less than 500 grand so you could pay actors cheaply with the independent film in the SAG, right?
Yes.
Okay. So there we go.
No one was SAG.
Really? Nobody? Lindsay, you weren't
maybe
SAG?
Jenny? No, I'm not. I am.
You still are not.
I
She's SAG eligible.
I don't think I am.
Anti-union. It's
I'm
at Pasadena.
Anti-union. I don't want the union getting mad at me. It's just that I like to be able to make movies.
They're so disorganized, they won't even get mad at you. They won't know who to get mad at.
I just want to be able to do what I want to do. I don't want to have a union tell me that I can.
So when you did...
Having produced, I also know how difficult it is sometimes.
I was going to say, you've done everything. So when you did Joe's movie, for instance, which you acted in, you didn't get a SAG card after that. I mean, obviously, you're eligible now.
I didn't get paid to act in Joe's movie.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. That was
Swanberg.
Just,
that son of a bitch.
I got to hang out with Jane all day.
Keeping
all
that sweet money for himself.
I'll hang out with Jane for free. I do hang out with Jane.
So, Will, did you join SAG yet?
No, I'm not even eligible, I don't think.
Really?
Yeah.
Even after doing this?
Yeah, this doesn't make it eligible.
Really?
Yeah.
How does that work?
It's got to be a SAG budget film, right? It's got to be like
this. Well,
a union production.
Yeah, which this was not.
Oh, okay. So this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. So you made a teacher. How many days was the shoot?
It was about a month total. With our shooting days though were quite short.
Okay. So you just was that a scheduling thing? Was that just how you chose to do it because of the heavy content?
And because the way that we ended up working on this was that we didn't really have rehearsal time before we started shooting. So we would rehearse a scene in the location that we were shooting, and then I would bring in the director of photography, Andrew Palermo, and show him how the scene was going to naturally play out. So the actors didn't have to worry about hitting their marks because the camera is just always going to follow them.
Okay. So talk to me then about how you got Lindsay involved. Well, first, let's talk about the script process.
Yeah.
All right. I know you did a lot of research on the film. I know you did a lot of research on test studies, case studies of women who were like Lindsay's character in the film. How did that come about? How did this whole idea come about, and how did you put it together? And how did you become so passionate about writing something so dark?
Well, I'm drawn to dark material.
Like Bad Boys. Yes.
Like Bad Boys.
I agree. I know.
Not dark.
No? There's cocaine and hookers and Taya Leone in that movie. And I think Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are pretty dark. But that's neither here nor there. Continue. She likes her dark material. We just found out Hannah loves black men. But continue.
I'm surprised. I tried to get Will Smith.
Is that a surprise?
I tried to get him to be black at one point.
You try to get Will to be black?
Yeah.
You know that doesn't work like that. You can't just, like, wish him black.
I don't remember this.
You don't?
You want his character to be black.
I wanted the kid to be black, but that changes the movie quite a bit.
Yeah.
Man, you were just racy. You were just like, how
can... Pushing all the
envelopes. Yeah. How can we make everybody in America not want to be, like, comfortable with this movie? Because you know nobody's going to be comfortable with this film, right? You're fine with that, I'm guessing, because you're dark.
That was the point.
Yeah, you're so... Hey, what's wrong with you?
Okay,
so talk to me about your demons here
so
that
good.
You wanted to write this. I know!
You can't
she
see
looks
her, but
like,
she looks like
every woman I've dated, and now I'm a little worried about every woman I've dated.
You should be worried about yourself.
Oh, I've been worried about myself. Long time. I'm going to men now. I'm going straight to men. It is the best way to go. Well, no. You're from Texas. You're not allowed to know that, right? No, they don't.
Yeah.
So tell me, Darkness. Yep. You wrote this script. How?
So let's see. Like I said, I'm drawn to kind of darker material, and I knew that I wanted to do a woman on the verge.
What's
type
some
story?
Movies that like? Really, not maybe inspired this film, but inspired you as an artist that you would consider your darkness is comparable to?
A Woman Under the Influence by John Cassavetes.
Mm-hmm. Great movie.
The Piano Teacher.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. I see how it is.
You know, there are quite a few. Actually, a film that I completely forgot about until earlier today, House of Pleasures, which is a...
I haven't seen that.
It was a French film that was at Cannes maybe 4 years ago.
Oh, really?
And really just a fantastic film that leaves you just feeling like you've been punched in the stomach, which is the way that I like my movies.
You like that.
Yeah. So, but for this specific idea, I was working at a restaurant. I was living in Austin, Texas at the time and was working at a restaurant.
What restaurant?
It was the Galaxy Cafe.
What's the best thing they served there?
Sweet potato fries.
Sweet potato. Really? Mac and cheese?
I would say the sweet potato fries, but we can agree to disagree.
Okay. Sweet potato fries. All right.
And a boy walked in who was in high school, and he was very clearly in high school because he was wearing his Letterman jacket.
Yeah, right.
He was with all his friends. And I found myself attracted to him, but it was not like a, oh man, I want to go have sex with him. It was more like
I hope
like
not.
A
I hope not. Yeah.
She had to say that.
Yeah, right.
It was more.
You were like, he's going to be really hot in a year.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right, 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 right.
In 12 months.
Right, in 12 months. She was scouting. It was draft pick. She's got the first round draft pick.
Right.
Yeah.
But seeing him, I was attracted. He was the kind of guy I would have been into in
sure,
high school.
Sure, would have, yeah.
Right.
Right.
So he represented to me a time in my life where I didn't have to worry about, you know, getting my taxes done.
Okay. So
in time and
you know, in a fucked up way, you're saying you're the teacher.
Sure, I'll be
yeah,
the
you're
first
totally
to admit
cool
it.
With that.
Yeah, I mean.
Why do you think she wrote it?
That said, I did not talk to this boy once. He has no idea who I am.
But in a weird way, is this screenplay like acting out a weird fantasy?
I
like that you would never act out on?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
In a way.
A fantasy, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Well.
See, it's your fantasy, my nightmare.
Nightmares without consequences can be fantasies. Yeah. So tell me more about how you got immersed in the script, because I know as a writer you really have to love something in order to keep writing it, because sometimes I'll write 30 pages and then not be in love with it and be like, see you later.
Yeah, I'm no, bored. This one came pretty easily. I just put, you know, parts of myself into the film, and to be honest, it's really, I mean, of course, the surface, it's about a teacher who has an affair with one of her students. Mm-hmm. But to me, that really stands for any sort of illicit relationship you can have. So whether it's you're having an affair with someone you shouldn't be having an affair with or what have you. So I could take my experiences from being in that situation and putting it into, you know, this teacher student.
Fly.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was listening. No one can hear. No one can see us.
Right.
That's the thing. So everyone just thinks, boy, that's really awkward. A fly flew in front of my face, and it was distracting.
And it's still
me.
Flying around.
Is it still? And I think it's like a gnat. I think it's like a fruit fly or something, too, which is even worse. It's the Madea poster behind me.
It's
shit attracts flies. I don't know if you know that, but what?
Is that some smack talking?
No, that's not smack talking. I thought, like, you could be the shit. Whatever. It's definitely, well, that's a good point, too. It could be Watchmen, too. Okay, so you're immersed in this dark, dark world.
Yeah.
What's the next step after you write the script? How many drafts did you write?
3.
That's it. And you were like, this is how we're doing it. But there was some collaboration during the filming.
Oh, very much so.
One thing about Hannah is she works so fast.
Yeah.
She's so fast. She came to me with this idea in, I think it was it October or September?
September.
We had a complete script, and we were doing our little pre-production honeymoon in January. We were shooting in February, and we premiered in the next January. It just all happened.
That's good, though.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, you hear about that in, like, you know, on $5,000, $10,000 movies, because you got 10 days to shoot whatever, and you're editing, like, right there, and you don't have a lot of cuts, but... On a movie a little bigger than that, that's impressive to have that kind of turnaround.
Very focused.
But I think, and would you agree, Lindsay, that you think it's because Hannah just knew everything she wanted when she wanted it? Maybe not from the beginning, but like when you wanted it, did you know you wanted it?
No.
Really?
Yeah. I think everyone who worked on the film participated in helping make it into what it was and helping shape the characters, and I let Will and Lindsay go wild with their own imaginations as to not only their own backstory but their relationship's backstory but also their personal character backstory.
So Lindsay, what drew you to the material?
Well, as soon as she mentioned the concept to me, I thought it was a great idea
great
for a movie.
Great role for an actress,
it's just
too.
An amazing role. Yeah, I mean, right. You just don't come across roles that are that
interesting. How did you get approached for this? Was she like one of the first people you approached, or was there an audition process, or what?
No, she was the first person I approached, and we were at dinner at an Indian restaurant.
In Brooklyn, New York.
Really?
We were already friends.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So that helps.
Yeah. We had worked together before, and we were already friends.
What did you guys work together on?
I made a short film called We're Glad You're Here.
So where did the friendship begin? On that?
Before that, actually.
Before that. How did you guys become friends?
I worked at the front desk at a commercial production company in New York.
Okay.
And Lindsay produced stuff there. And we were the young kids in the office. So
we just started hanging. We lived near each other.
You're still young. I just turned 30 today.
Happy birthday.
Today?
Yeah, today.
Whoa.
I know.
This is your
I'm
birthday?
Working on my birthday.
I worked on my birthday,
see?
Too.
There we go. Leo, see?
I worked on my birthday. There's something good about working on your birthday, I think.
Is there?
I think.
I don't know. Did you? Yeah. Well, you filmed.
So that...
Yeah, you were doing something you liked, though, right? No? Oh, you
what?
Worked
on. Are you saying you don't like this?
Yeah. I'd rather be doing what she's doing
than
what you're doing. Sure.
Really?
Sure. I mean, I love doing this. I love hanging out with you guys, but... You know, am I doing what I want to do? Just like when you were at the commercial production company.
Yeah.
Well, you're only 30. You can do whatever you want.
Sure. Sure. That's what they tell you. That's what they tell you.
It's true.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Will, and if we can give Will the mic for a minute, because I know he's got ADD. I could tell. How old are you?
23.
You got ADD. Okay. here's the deal. I hope you took your Adderall today.
Right. Not a prescription for it.
No? No prescription? Or you do?
No, I don't take it.
Oh, okay.
That's why I'm...
I do that.
Well, you say you don't have a prescription. That don't mean you don't take it.
No, I don't take it.
All right, good for you. Stay away from that shit. Listen, what did you How did you get involved with this project?
I auditioned for it. My agent sent me the submission, and I read the script.
Is this your first thing, or did you do commercials?
I did a super low budget student feature, and then I did a super low budget student short at UT in Austin, and then I did this.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you auditioned for this,
uh-huh.
and you just look like a 17-year-old football player guy, right?
Yeah.
He had the perfect look. How'd you know that he had the chops?
He auditioned.
Yeah, but I mean, what did you do in the audition?
First, he showed up in a camouflage pickup truck.
You did.
1999.
I mean, you
Toyota.
Did. You did. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. He did. Then he.
Hey. It was a beast. It was. I don't have any.
Then he was smoking a cigarette.
Oh, well, that I can relate to. I mean, not smoking a cigarette.
Right.
An electronic
cigarette
thing.
Right. It was for the character.
Yeah, he was
because,
all into it.
You know, high school people like acting cool.
I don't smoke
older.
Either, Mom.
Then he smelled like Acqua di Gio.
Oh.
Acqua di Gio.
You were so high school, bro.
It was actually Stetson Black.
Did you go in like that? Were you like... Stetson Black, this is real.
I went in. I did.
You did?
You daggum right, I did. Yeah. Huh?
You knew what you were doing?
Yeah, I knew what I was doing. I was getting into the character as much as you get into the character for an audition. Yeah.
Did you really? You
I showed up to the audition like I would show up to a date in high school.
Really?
I don't believe it.
I kind of do. I believe them.
But showing up to a date, showing up to an audition, the same thing. You want to look good, smell good, and be charismatic.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Oh, well, yeah. Now I totally believe you, but it's not as fascinating. I thought you were doing some Brando shit, and
you were trying to hit on. Hannah and I did go on a ride and get milkshakes later, but...
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
that's
really?
A joke.
I was going to say, that's fast. That's a really good audition.
This.
That's a great audition.
All the pain and all the milkshakes.
So are all three living out here now?
Lindsay's
too good.
Yeah.
Understandable.
No, Lindsay. I just, all my friends are in New York.
All your friends
not
are
true.
In New York.
That's not true. I'm from here, so I have...
Pasadena, right?
Yeah. So
I love Pasadena.
It's nice.
I do.
It took me
really
until
nice.
I was older
to
realize
appreciate
that it's nice.
It?
Yes. Yep. But,
well, it is an older kind of town.
Well, I like the older town part of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just the, you know...
Oh, the people thing?
Yeah, well, it's a little sheltered.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting
yeah.
it. You could go into politics, too, you know.
Yeah.
You'd
I'm,
be good at that.
Yeah, I think I might try to be a senator or something like that.
That's good. Your next film, you do a sequel where she's a senator who
senator.
Sleeps with women.
Ooh. Sleeps with women.
And taps her feet in airport stalls. That's great. I think that's a gay guy thing, but I don't know.
I don't, yeah, I'm like, what is that?
But gay men do it. They, like, tap their feet in airport
that's
stalls.
That's the...
That was the guy. What's,
the code?
Yeah, well, yeah, which congressman did it? Some congressman
oh,
did it.
Right.
Right.
I forgot about it, yeah.
I love how you're looking at me like, he knows a lot about tapping his feet. Yeah, because I do it at LAX all the time. No, it happened. I read a newspaper. I'm not filming movies. So tell me about New York. You are you staying in New York?
I live in Brooklyn. I've lived there for a little while now, and Hannah used to live there as well. I love New York.
Yeah.
It's vibrant, and it's inspiring, and has so much energy. I'm not sure I want to live there for too much longer, though.
Yeah, I was talking to, we had Paul Sorvino on the other day, and we were talking about independent film in New York and how it used to be amazing in the 70s and the 60s and the 80s. Not so much anymore.
Right.
There's not a lot going on, like, independent film-wise, like... It just seems like the market's like less. There's less work there now,
there's
right?
There's a great, to be honest, there's a great independent film community.
No, the artistry is great.
Small.
The community is
yeah.
great, but it got a lot smaller, and the media doesn't talk about
media
it as
doesn't
much
pay
anymore.
Attention
that's
at
what
all.
I'm talking about.
But the films are, there's some amazing
films coming out of there are great.
Coming at it from New York directors. And
like Gimme the Loop.
Right.
Yeah.
And,
right.
and many more.
Right.
But they're small and they can't get the money. Nobody knows about them, so nobody gives them the money to make their movies.
But like
so
the days of Woody Allen, Woody's not even in New York anymore.
What do you mean?
He did that movie with Larry David, and he's like, hey, I'm not filming here anymore. I'm not doing New York anymore. Woody even left New York.
I know.
That's
he's
sad.
Like, Rome is nice.
Yeah, he got bored. No, he was in
San
Francisco for Blue Jasmine. He's like, I want to travel.
I know, and that's why we all wanted to make movies in New York.
Is he the luckiest man alive, Woody Allen, that he keeps getting funded? I mean, the guy didn't make a hit for, like, ever, and then now he's making money. Now his movies are actually making money somehow. But, I mean, he's great. I love him.
But look at him. He's
but, like,
some
he's
of the best.
Luckiest man ever, though, right?
Well, he's made some of the best, I mean, to me at least. I love his movies. I mean,
but do people in Idaho give a shit? I don't know.
I don't know. What are they?
I don't think so.
Do they give a shit about any movies?
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. That's why you're lucky to be a guy like Woody Allen, where it's like when you make movies that are for a specific audience. Like this, when A Teacher Got Out There and South by Southwest, huge, and then you're named on like the 15 best films, and then you were named one of the best actresses going, and the indie actress to watch. that's kind of crazy, right? Because
totally
it's such
crazy.
A small scale like movie that like when something like that you feel a little lucky too, right? Even though you did a lot of hard work and you earn it, you do feel lucky, right?
Oh, not only do I feel lucky, but I feel like we have really great publicists.
You do. It's the same publicity company that does Madea's
Tyler
movies.
Perry's films.
And let me tell you something. If people will go see these, that's a great publicity
company. If you
like
Tyler Perry's movies, you'll love A Teacher.
Yeah. Basically, it'll be the same audience, I'm sure. Will, what's your favorite Tyler Perry movie? And which one inspired you to be an actor? He's like, don't do this to me. I want to work with the man. I want to do Madea.
Isn't there one where it's like Meet the Browns or something like that?
There is Meet the Browns. But it's a TV show, too. But there was the movie with Angela Bassett. They couldn't get her for the TV show, weird enough.
I've seen that movie, and it was actually kind of funny. That guy,
really?
That guy was in it, the one at the bottom there.
This guy?
Madea makes fun of his neck the whole time. She says every time he moves his head, he gets skid marks on his chest from his chin.
You saw that movie, Meet the Browns?
I saw that movie.
Well, you didn't have a lot to do the last few years, did you?
You know what?
How high were you?
What?
Yeah, well, I love that face. Yeah. You're so lucky you're not on film right now, because people would know how bad of a liar you are. All right. So, obviously, he's got this cute, like, Texas boy charm going on. Perfect for the role, right?
Right.
Yeah. Right. Okay. When you got this role, of course, this is a big deal for you because you were doing student films. And I mean, obviously, this isn't Transformers 5, but like, this is a great role, great script. This could go somewhere, right? That's what you're thinking?
I didn't know. You know, I remember asking Hannah on set at one point. What would be the best thing that could happen? And pretty much her answer was like, well, it could go to Sundance, you know. And I'm like, what are the chances of that? She's like, I don't know, you know. And then that happened.
Like Karnak.
And I didn't, I'm pretty ignorant to, not ignorant, just naive to film. I'm just new to it all, you know.
Right, and so
I was meeting with people after it made Sundance, and they're like, you realize this is pretty much the best thing that can happen to you other than getting the role in Transformers, you know, and the entire world seeing you. And I'm like, yeah, cool.
You know, and you should be really happy because I don't think Shia was so happy doing all those Transformers. He may be a very rich man, but he seems to really not want to do anything like that ever again. So you should consider yourself very blessed to be in the film.
I am very, very blessed.
How'd you come prepared for the shoot? Because obviously it's a little racy. Obviously you have to like have sex with Lindsay, which I'm sure is the worst thing ever.
Disgusting.
Or fake it. I mean, fake sex with Lindsay, obviously. Obviously.
Yeah.
So how'd you come prepared for that? Not just the sex, everything, but the sex.
I did my homework. I did what I knew to do from training.
And what kind of homework was this? Not Meet the Browns.
I mean, like script work. Come
on. Okay. All right. We're not talking Jenna Jameson homework.
Will's script, I've never seen anything like this. Maybe just because this is only the first feature I'd ever made, and I didn't go to film school, or worked on film sets. But Will's script was color-coded. It was beautiful.
Sold out Office Max from like highlighters and post-it notes with different colors.
Hey, you know, I did. You know, but what I learned is like that stuff isn't always necessary.
Because right.
Lindsay would like show up and be like, "What's
you know?" A lot of it's in the moment.
No,
too,
I'm kidding.
Right?
No, she's.
but how
it
much?
Was more, I think her way of working is different than mine. Everyone has.
How much
I'm
do you?
I'm like super, super private, and so yeah. if yeah. the to me the notion of somebody coming upon my script and seeing those notes, like that
out.
Makes me
no.
want to kill myself.
I'd flip out.
Yeah, I think yeah. you guys did. You were like looking through it, and I was like, what are you doing?
Now, you're a guy though. It's different. Well, women don't give a shit about. Like women are so weird. Like they can go through your journal and it's cool
right.
in the gang.
Oh,
if
man.
You go through their shit, it's over.
Oh yeah.
It's over. You're
I
fucked.
Kill somebody.
They will fuck you up.
I mean, I would just die.
Right.
And
if someone goes
the
through
script
your
script. For me, it's
See,
so...
when I act, it's weird. I don't like taking notes in my script, so I find this interesting. How many of them do you really use them?
I don't use them. I take first impression notes. As I'm reading through it, because usually your first instinct is your best instinct,
yeah.
and
you're great,
and,
brother. I love that. That's
so,
great. Yeah.
So I mean, that's that. The first time I read the script, that's what I did.
So how much of that did you use? Would you
pretty
say?
Pretty much 90% of it.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So you
because
took
you
the
go
first impression, well, and then you acted in the moment.
Then you, yeah, because then you start overthinking it and all that stuff. I don't know. I memorized the lines, and then we just did the thing. You
that's
know?
Good, man. All right, Lindsay, you don't do a lot of notes, right?
I don't do a lot of notes because
no.
if somebody finds them, I'll kill myself.
Yeah, I used
yeah.
to with theater. I would like write a ton of notes in my like playbooks. And stuff.
What I do have is I have a journal. I always have a journal.
Yeah,
and I write as the character.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just like
and you're like Nick Nolte. You're a weirdo.
I don't know.
You know about Nick Nolte?
No, tell me about him.
Hannah, you know about Nick Nolte?
No, tell me.
Really? Okay, you'll love this. Okay, Nick Nolte. When any role. So imagine. The worst movie he's ever done, okay? Because he's done, oh, like, a million great movies, but I always try to remember, like, the one studio piece of shit he did where he still did this. Another 48 Hours, okay? He gets a character, and he will write everything that happened to that character before the movie from the day he was born, like 30, 40 pages, and he'll hand it to the director, and he'll be like, This is what the character does. this is who I am. And like he writes a whole backstory, but a crazy fucking like 40-page backstory, like a book. He's nuts.
Yeah,
he's like,
I don't.
So
do
I
that.
Imagine him doing like another 48 hours between 48 hours and another 48 hours. He wrote a sequel to the book he wrote for the guy for 48 hours. I just think he's the most fascinating man ever, but that's how he gets into it. So in a weird way, you don't do that.
I don't do that. I do different things, though. Like, I try to kind of dream.
You drink like Nick Nolte? He doesn't drink anymore.
Dream?
Oh, dream. I'm sorry.
I try to have, like, dreams in the character, yeah. which happens and is awesome. I get really attached to this.
It really happens? You have dreams as the character?
Yeah.
Did you have dreams as this character?
Yeah. I mean, you dream like past experiences and like the kinds of dreams that the character would have, anxiety dreams.
What kind of dream did you have?
I don't know. I'm not going to tell you my dreams.
Really?
I have really
you
weird
are
dreams.
You are too good.
No.
Too good.
Stop it.
Brooklyn. not sharing. Got
but,
it.
But okay. What I do, Ollie, will say, I get really attached to the script.
If
I
sign an NDA, will you tell me your dreams?
Maybe.
Like, off the record? Like, I'll sign an NDA.
Maybe. If I'll hypnotize you. I'll whisper them in your ear.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
But I do get really attached to the script. I love scripts. And so even though I don't write notes in them, I have, like, I like, if I turn to the page, then just seeing that page will kind of, it, like, gives me all the information yeah. before it, which
so,
is, like...
So you never want to be, like, certain A-list actors who have, like, other people read their scripts, and they're like, tell me how it is.
Oh, no way.
And then I'll do it.
No way. You get so
My mom
much
said it's really
script.
Good.
You get wow. so much information from a script, like, so much.
Sure.
I mean, just the specific wording that somebody uses as yeah. versus the wording that you use. It's
yeah.
just...
So let me ask you, Will, was there anything really like, because this is disturbing in a way, but there's a lot of guys out there who are hot for teacher and they're, you know, it's kind of a fantasy for some 17-year-olds. When I was 14, 15, I wanted to bang some of my teachers. You're fucking horny. You're going through puberty, all that shit. So for a guy, and you're not far from that age, so was it fucked up for you? Was it like kind of in a weird way fantasy fulfilling? Like, what's the deal? How'd you take to it?
I approached it like a legitimate relationship. Like, they were really into each other. Like, he was really into this chick. Sure, it started as like, heck yeah, fantasy, let's do it, you know. But then I think from my story was that it was real, you know. They really had feelings for each other, which It just made it easier for me. It just made it all justified for me personally, and then it made it more difficult when it had to end.
See, I got to imagine for Lindsay, because her character's so dark and the material's so dark, throughout the actual filming process, there had to be some moments where you're like really worn down and feeling it. For you, where's that? Because you don't really have, you get to be the sexual, like,
yeah,
you know, plaything. You're
right.
The Mrs. Robinson in a weird way,
yeah,
right?
It was.
So do you have those moments where you're like, this is heavy shit? Or are you like, this is kind of fun?
I had that when we, the final sex scene, I had that. And I think that was just due to personal life, too, because I was going to school, taking a full class load. And then we filmed that scene. We wrapped at like 5 a.m. in the morning. And then I had a personal training session at 5:30 a.m.
And you were in the middle of finals.
And I was in the middle of finals. I was up for like 48 hours when we did that scene, which was, in hindsight, great for the acting, because it was just like, when you're that exhausted, you can't do anything
awesome.
But just be in the moment, you
yeah,
know.
Awesome.
But but otherwise, no, I'd show up to set and it was a party. It was like, heck yeah, all right, let's do it. You know, it's fun. It was easy and she had the hard work, you
See,
know.
That's why you got to work out at midnight like I do. 24-hour fitness. Make them live up to their name. That's what I do. Let me ask you about the ending, Hannah, because obviously everyone's going to be talking about which is what you want.
Yeah.
I was talking to Joe Swanberg yesterday, and Joe and I had a conversation about where it's like you want people to walk away from your films sometimes either pissed, but you want them feeling something.
Yeah.
Right? So ambiguous is the ending. We're not going to give it away, but talk about the ambiguity of just in general terms, if you have to.
Sure. We don't know at the end of the film what is going to end up happening to the character of Diana, which I did on purpose because I just don't like movies that give all the answers away. And by doing this...
Bad Boys.
Right. I mean, but I like that kind of movie. But for a film like this, you know...
But wouldn't Bad Boys have been cooler if the bad guy kind of gets away at the end?
Yeah.
By the way, why don't they make that action movie anymore? There used to be action movies where the bad guy gets away at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sure. The first Batman, Joker dies. Well, no, they all fucking die. Yeah, people die. Oh, Superman. The first Superman, Lex Luthor lives. He just goes to jail, whatever. But he comes back in the second one. They don't make that movie anymore.
Yeah, they should.
Everyone dies now.
Yeah. Silly.
I fucking hate movies. Continue, though. Continue. So you left yours ambiguous because?
Because I don't like... I felt like if I left it ambiguous, audience people mm-hmm. would leave the film still thinking about it.
Yeah.
So that's...
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Lindsay or Will, either one of you can do this, or both of you. What did you think of the end of the film? Like, when you read the script for the first time, you're like, am I missing pages?
It actually changed over time.
It did?
So
was there, like, a finality to...
Should I give away
at any point
old
in time?
Versions of the ending?
Yeah.
We've never discussed this one old version of the ending where you had me get into a car crash and die.
I don't remember that.
Hannah does not remember her own...
Wow.
draft process, but I do.
I want to get like a shrink in this room because I think all four of us need one for different reasons
so
across
sick.
The board. Yeah, I have my own
issues.
Yeah,
what issues. About you? You're left out.
No,
you're
he's
totally
okay. Fine. He's quiet. He's reading. He thought the movie was fucked up like a normal person. I'm like, it's kind of hot. It's kind of cool. She's interesting. I want a blowjob now. Like, I'm fucked up. You guys.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was one version of the ending. And I
do not remember that. That's really funny.
You're killing
so
people off in, like, fantasy scripts that you don't remember ever writing.
I know. But I thought it was a really cool ending. I thought it was a great ending.
Yeah.
And I loved not knowing what was going to happen to her next.
Okay.
Because that meant that I could have a different idea about it than Hannah did.
What about you, Will? Well, you were used to this because you were doing student films, and all these student films are like,
well, you know,
good
I don't,
guy dies at the end.
I've only done two, but one thing I will say about the ending, I like the ending. I love the ending.
Okay.
if you ever watch the ending, next time you watch the film, if you watch it again, watch the cell phone, because I love how the cell phone stays tangled up in her sweatshirt.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's really nice. But something I want to say about the acting is that what blew me away after seeing that scene was the fact that literally like 45 minutes before that, Lindsay and I had just wrapped like a pretty light scene at the ranch and driven 2 hours across Central Texas, like windows down, having good conversation. Went had fajitas at a Mexican restaurant and margaritas with the crew, and then they filmed that scene. And it's like, me personally as an actor, I would have been like depressed and hit myself in the head all day long to be able to pull that off. But it's a little tribute to Burge's talent there.
Thanks.
Yeah, welcome.
She's just a fun-loving broad.
She's just a fun chick.
Fun-loving broad.
Fun chick from Brooklyn.
Not a care in the world. Not,
no cares in
Liz
the world.
Liz Taylor during the day.
Does movies for free.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't care about
Lives
money.
Lives in Brooklyn. Yeah, you should never
Guys, she'll work for free.
I will never work.
Your agent hates your guts right now. He's like, you did not work for free.
I got so many cheeseburgers out of it.
Swanberg gave you so much beer. It was way worth it.
Swanberg's a friend, okay?
Yeah, did he make you his craft beer? Is that what he did?
We did
was that
go
your
out
payment?
For craft beer. Yeah, see, that did happen.
There you go.
He was
did he make you a batch of his own beer? He stayed at your mom's house. See, he doesn't tell me how cheap he is.
Well, that movie was special.
He's so cheap.
That
he
movie was
tell
special.
Me how cheap.
He's not going to be that cheap anymore.
I know. What
yeah.
a fucker.
He's got a son.
You should ask him if you see him again. Ask him what he...
I'm going to see him in Chicago next month.
Ask him what he thinks about a teacher.
I will ask him.
Yeah.
I will. Have he seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? What did he tell you?
He really likes it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously, but what did he tell you about you?
He didn't say anything about me.
Yeah, right. It's a little awkward?
No, I don't think so.
We're talking about a guy who whips out his dick and jerks off in half.
Yeah,
movie,
I don't think
he's not too uncomfortable. Yeah, I think he's all right with that anyways.
He said he just wants to remake it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's what he said.
Well, yeah. After he saw it at a film festival, we were all hanging out, and he's like, I just can't wait to remake your movie.
I just want to rip it off. Just wants to rip it off.
It does have a little Fatal Attraction vibe to it. You know that's what will happen, though, if like a studio was like, we're gonna buy this and make it another, thing. It's going to be Fatal Attraction, or it'll be Basic Instinct Fatal Attraction.
See.
Or it'll be Fatal Instinct.
We'll see.
Oh, is there stuff I don't know about?
Dun, dun, dun.
I don't like this shit. I don't like this. Keeping shit from me. All right. Well, I'm not going to keep you guys much longer. You guys got lives.
It's
obviously.
Your birthday.
I'm on my birthday and I don't
but
have
yeah.
a life.
Yeah, we want to talk about your birthday.
I'm going to the gym.
That's
at like 10 o'clock.
Are you going to
Which
Drinking Buddies tonight?
I'm going
tonight?
To a premiere.
Which one?
No, I'm going to a premiere for, last I heard, for Paul Sorvino.
Oh, yeah. What movie is that?
Last I Heard. It's really, 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 really good.
Really?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, it's
Who
Paul
directed it?
David Rodriguez, and it's Paul Sorvino's best work ever.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean that. And think about Paul Sorvino's career.
Yeah.
It is his best work ever. And Rappaport's great in it, and Chaz Palminteri, and who else is in it? Stephen Bauer, Paul Benvictor,
cool.
Renee Props. Yeah, it's really good.
Where's the premiere?
Holly Shorts. It's at the Grauman. Yeah. Yeah. Are you doing the Drinking Buddies thing today?
Yeah.
You are. Are you?
I'm supposed to.
You're supposed to? It's a good movie.
Yeah. No, I've
seen it.
It's great.
You've seen
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
You've seen it.
I've seen it.
Will, have you seen Drinking Buddies? No. You have nothing to do tonight, do you?
I'm going to go home and watch Bad Boys 2 for the first time.
Are you going to watch Bad Boys 2? No.
Have you really never
you
seen
need to,
I've never
You
seen
need
it.
To borrow Bad Boys 1 for me so you can listen to the director's commentary.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's what you
I have
to
nothing
do.
To do, though. You're right.
Go to the gym.
That's all I do, really.
Well, that's all I do, so we're even.
Yeah.
We have no lives.
None.
Losers.
I just stare at walls all day.
I believe it. Don't gotta sell me. And don't forget, download Candy Crush. And but everyone should go see a teacher. Fascinating, fascinating film. And it's definitely, I think, I don't like awards. So I don't really give a shit, but it should get awards buzz. Like, in a perfect world, like, if I did like awards, that would be an awards movie, right?
Well, thank you.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Let's all just agree.
Yeah.
It should be an awards
Agreed?
Movie.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. Lindsay should win an award. Yeah, you should all win an award. You all win the Matthew Aaron Doesn't Give a Shit About Awards Award.
Great.
Well done.
Rock on.
I, what an honor. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's all politics. It sucks. That's a different conversation, different thing. Fuck awards. All right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great.
So
thank you.
Oh,
yeah.
Happy birthday.
All right. Yeah. All right. That was the interview with Hannah, Will, and Lindsay Burge, Will Britton, Hannah Fidel, and Lindsay Burge from A Teacher, which you could check out on video on demand now. It's a fascinating film, and when I say fascinating, I don't mean like one of those interesting pieces of crap. It's very enjoyable. It's a very, very good film. Not like a Michael Bay. So I had a great time with them. They were fantastic, and Lindsay... she's better in this film than Jessica Chastain's been in anything. So take that for what you will. In my mind, in my own humble opinion. And the next segment of the show, I talked to Rudy Mick. Rudy Mick has his own company and the Mick Method, which you're going to hear about. But Rudy, of course, is an entrepreneur, and he's a guy that comes in and he takes over restaurants, whether they're in the beginning phases or they're in a struggling phase or they just want to change. And Rudy's the guy that consults them through it and basically reinvents their restaurant or invents it with them. He is the real life kitchen nightmares. So this is a fascinating interview. It's definitely if you're any interest in food or the restaurant business, it's must listen. And, anyone that, of course, is a fan of the Gordon Ramsay show, which I'm sure many of you are, this is also a must-listen because we get to definitely get in on the inside of this and see what it's like in real life. So here's Rudy Mick, and we will be back after that to wrap up. All right, this is Matthew Aaron here with Rudy Mick of Rudy Mick. We were just talking about Ralph Lauren of Ralph Lauren. So you're like the Ralph Lauren of the food industry.
Absolutely.
Explain to our listeners, and we're here at Taste Chicago, by the way, 603 North Hollywood Way, Burbank, California. Explain to our listeners what it is exactly you do for the restaurant industry. Because it's fascinating, because you're one of those, you're kind of like a middleman in a way. You're like an unseen guy, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so how does that work?
Well, first, Matt, thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, thanks
totally
for doing
cool.
it.
Totally cool. What we do, really, with restaurateurs around the United States and actually around the world, is we'll work with them in three ways. Either new project development, so you have an idea for a concept. We can actually take it from soup to nuts, from the idea to the actual opening of a restaurant under the context of a chain, so they could actually build that restaurant out.
Yeah.
Which leads us to the second thing we do, which is growth. So single restaurants, maybe two, building those out to, if you've got two, we can build 10. If you've got 10 to 50. So startups, growth. The other thing we do is operational turnaround. So working with an existing company, restaurant company, to improve the performance and the work they're doing.
Sure.
And so in all three of those realms, we work with leadership and teams, managers, to build systems and a consistent approach that celebrates food and beverage.
Now, do you find when you are doing the second route where you're improving a company that's already out there, are you finding holes in their or flaws in what they're doing and improve on those, or are you creating new methods or a little of both, or what is exactly you do?
Well, I love the way you pose the question. The first thing we'll do is take a look at what they're doing, ideally what they're doing well.
Yeah.
And whatever they're not doing, can we build on what they're doing well and fill in the blanks with systems, management systems or operating systems, menu development, in a way that supports the things that they're already doing? So really there's three things. What are they doing that they ought to keep doing? What could they start doing that they're not doing? And maybe what should they stop doing that isn't actually serving their client and their business.
Was there a project you remember like the most, maybe when you were starting this company, where you took a restaurant or you took an up-and-coming restaurant and made it like a success? Like, what's the most memorable project out of the gates for you? What was the one that was like, this is going to work for us?
Well, one of our most famous was actually here in Los Angeles with a little a restaurant chain now called Merrick's Tex-Mex Cafe in West Hollywood.
Okay, yeah.
Amazingly enough.
Yeah, Merrick's,
When that started out.
Taco Tuesday.
Absolutely. When that first started
out. They're packed now all the time. You wouldn't think they ever had a problem.
When we first started that concept years and years ago, it was originally a contemporary California cuisine, night, soft,
sure,
tragically hip little restaurant that was inconsistent as heck, well-intentioned, but the operators couldn't quite figure out their passion, their sense of clarity so that the restaurant was consistent day in and day out. And what we began to talk about was their passion for Tex-Mex food.
Before you came aboard, it was basically a Mexican restaurant, Tex-Mex or
it was
what?
Actually California cuisine. It was contemporary,
really?
American food.
So it didn't even have like a Mexican flair,
nope,
to it or
not
anything
at
this point in time. It was a huge menu of, yep, just random California cuisine.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what ended up happening was first we talked about where is the owners of the restaurant, where is their passion. What food do they most love? What food do they most know?
Yeah.
And one of the two owners is actually from Texas. And at that point in time, Tex-Mex food had not even been to California.
No.
And we took a month, redid the menu, redid the design of the restaurant, redid all the management systems, worked on the menu, opened it, and it kicked from day one.
That's great. And now they're so successful, they got the restaurant next door.
Yep.
They got another restaurant,
yep,
in the area as well.
Yep.
I mean, they're doing really well now.
They've done a terrific job for 27
years. Did you help them out with their future
years.
Restaurants, too, that they installed as well?
Yes and no. Yep.
Yeah.
Both.
Okay. Okay, so that was one of your first big projects when
that's
you opened
your company.
That's one of
our first big projects in L.A.
Yeah, and you absolutely knew that, and you knew at that point. Was that the point you knew it was going to work, or you knew from day one, or what?
We just put the project together from this first a place of what is it we love doing. Second, how do we put fiscal systems in place that anticipate our profitability and our performance? So, and that's part of our skill set as well. So
yeah,
not just taking the idea, but the business execution.
Yeah.
And then we talked about it very clearly and created management systems around it.
What
those systems?
What makes
play.
Your job different from consulting? Because
well,
you do a lot of consulting,
absolutely,
obviously. But what makes it different?
I think the difference in our approach to consulting, because in reality we are
sure
consulting.
You're under the umbrella,
yep,
of consulting, but
what,
it's different. Yeah.
What makes our work is that we become a partner to the client. Instead of standing over on the sideline like a football coach, we're actually going to get on the field with you, if I use that,
yeah,
metaphor. So
well, it seems like you're hands-on. Yeah.
We're very hands-on. And an equation or a metaphor we'll use a lot of times is it's like climbing a mountain. You're going to carry your own pack. You maybe have not climbed a mountain before. We've climbed hundreds, even thousands. We might not have climbed this mountain, but we've climbed thousands.
Yeah.
So we both carry our own gear. And what we do really well at MIC is make sure that as you're about to step off a cliff, we go, whoa, there you stop. Right, so we work together,
yeah,
we summit, and we get home safely and successfully.
So you're like the nice Gordon Ramsay. How many people compare you to like Kitchen Nightmares and Restaurant Impossible? And do you watch those shows and you're like, that's kind of bullshit?
Well, you know what? Who can put down Gordon Ramsay's amazing success?
Well, that's,
and
yeah,
his James Beard Awards and,
yeah,
all,
sure,
of that, right? So to your point, what we don't do is scream at our clients, and we gave up screaming at people a long time ago.
Yeah.
That said, we are really, really clear and really supportive. So
do you ever
the
see disasters side? Like on that show when you go in to fix up a restaurant?
Constantly.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So from there, I can join your assessment as We can scream and yell to fix things or change things, or we can actually just say, you know what, there's an option, and with a little bit less drama, but very high performance, gets things turned around quickly.
Do you find, because a lot of restaurants are owned by more than one person or they're family ran, that there's like politics when they bring a company like yours on, like someone really wants you there and they're paying for you to be there and they know you're going to fix up the restaurant, and then there's someone else that doesn't want you there and think whatever they're doing is perfect?
Absolutely.
And how do you deal with a situation like that?
Well, one of the things that, well, first of all, I love your observation, because that kind of chaos reigns.
Yeah.
And it might be couples, it might be families, it's mixed group of investors. Any of those things build high drama.
Yeah.
And so what we actually do really well is cut through the drama and give people, one of the systems we use is actually a communication process that actually supports families or couples or investors to slow down just a touch and actually shift name-calling and yelling into, well, wait, what's data? What is information? So if this dish sucks, what makes it suck?
Right.
So is it that the portion's too big or too small? Is it that there's too much cayenne or too much cumin?
And how do you get this data? Is it preference-based from your company, or is it based off of testing? Or,
well, I love your question.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, in a dialogue like that with investors, the conversation may be, well, wait, as soon as I hear something like it or that sucks, I'm going to ask, wait, what's the that?
Yeah, right. What's it's just it and that's what's that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just something that simple, right?
Yeah.
The that. What is the issue that is
but what
it,
may be too much salt to one person may be not enough to another.
Exactly.
So how do you deal with something like that?
So I love your example.
Yeah.
So if we actually slow down and go, well, yeah, it sucks. It's salty. It is the salt. You're spot on, man. So if all of a sudden we begin to be able to describe the saltiness or the over-seasoning of something, anything, now we can, as a group, begin to figure out, well, how much salt is enough?
Yeah.
How much is too much? How much is too little? And we can collectively begin to agree about the salt content. And so the salt that you're talking about in a dish can become the dollar amount we charge for a dish or a drink, how much tequila ought to be in the cocktail or how much scotch, right? Or how much salt or pepper or how many ounces of meat. So the its begin to be broken down into it, the ingredient or the service style.
Do you ever take a menu and drinks, like you were talking about, how much scotch to put in something, or how much tequila. Tequila is a great example, and spices are a great example. And do you ever gear them towards the brand that you're trying to build? So let's say it's a Mexican food joint, like we were talking. So you want a little spicier, or you want spicy options, or you want more tequila.
Yep.
Do you ever like? Yeah, you do that.
So absolutely, one of the really cool things about our business is every one of these brands. Right, any name brand we wanted to name of tequila, every one of those brands has a taste profile.
Okay.
Same thing with food ingredients. This is one of the things that makes food and beverage so radically fun, is because every one of those flavors and brands has a profile.
Yeah.
So a drink is going to, or a dish is going to taste a little bit different with this chili or that chili.
Based off of what's in it, based off of, it's just like cologne. Each cologne smells different because of the ingredients in it, right?
Yep.
Even in scotch and stuff, there's different ingredients in everyone's scotch.
What part of Scotland does the scotch come from?
Yeah.
How is it brewed?
Yeah.
How is it, which grains are it made, is it made out of? What are the highlights that it comes from?
Right.
Right, that are or pronounced in the development of it, and depending on those flavor profiles, the product is going to sell or not sell. So all of a sudden we can be very, very specific about all those things.
How often when you come in work with either a new company or with an existing company, do you find the issue is with the location and they're overpaying for the location? So let's say you wanted a place on Lakeshore Drive,
yep.
but it's like a mom-pop hot dog stand or a mom-pop hamburger joint, and you can't afford the lease or you can't afford the
yep.
rent, and there's no way they may ever make that money. Do you see that as a stumbling block, as a roadblock? Do you ever come across that where people are paying too much for a location?
Yes.
Is location ever a problem, and what do you do about location because you're locked in?
So there's a paradox with location.
Yeah.
On one big... generality, the old paraphrase of location, location,
yeah.
location is really true. And simultaneously in the restaurant business, we're one of the great industries that breaks new neighborhoods. And right?
Yeah.
Restaurants come first, then come the art galleries.
That's how the neighborhoods get built.
Absolutely.
You're right.
So,
Old Town in Chicago is a great example.
Yep.
Old Town was restaurants before it was, and then Second City, and you know, they
yep.
had everything going on. Twin Anchors was there, though, and Topo Gigio, and... Sure, absolutely.
You know your restaurants,
I
dude.
Do.
It's great.
I know my food.
I love that. I love it. So there's the interesting paradox of sometimes the location can be ideal but really radically expensive.
Yeah.
And a lot of startup restaurants will end up breaking new ground because the only property they can afford is in some second tier
sure.
B location. So the good news is that can really work if you've done all your other homework.
Yeah.
That off location can be actually a benefit.
Well, you look at a place like Superdog in Chicago,
yep.
and you have to maybe think Superdog. Would they have liked to have the money to maybe put it on Michigan Avenue? I'm sure.
Sure.
But look
sure.
what they did with it.
Sure.
They built it up, and it's a beast.
Sure.
And people came there. People
yep.
started coming there.
Absolutely. And you can look in neighborhoods and cities like L.A. where Silver Lake was nothing.
Sure.
And all
look
of a sudden,
Pink's.
Boom.
It's the only
exactly.
thing. Pink's
yep.
is the only hot dog stand in the middle of that whole area.
Yep.
Like, you can't eat anywhere else in that area
yep.
in La Brea. There's
yep.
nowhere else to
yep.
eat. It's Pink's.
Yep. So these are all the happy notes.
Sure.
The sad notes
yeah.
at times, and I cannot tell you how often this occurs, is a client will call and say, I just signed a lease, and they didn't do their homework, so they've ended up signing a lease that will never pay for itself. They might as well shut down before they even start.
Sure.
Right? So there are, from a fiscal place, there are rent averages that will work.
Yeah.
There are other averages that are going to be too high and too expensive, and you will never make money.
Yeah.
So there's the both end of that conversation, and it could be a radio show of its own.
Now, you know a bit about Chicago, and we
mm-hmm.
talk about L.A. as well, but in Chicago right now, there's a fad I've noticed, and it's a fad that's not working out, but they tried to bring in all these smaller, more trendy, more hip Italian restaurants like RPM.
Mm-hmm.
RPM's still open, but a lot of restaurants closed down that they brought in, and they were putting in
yep.
Alex Dana's corporation. I forget what it was called, but they had a restaurant
yep.
a few months ago, and now they just put in what's the new one? Well, they just put in a new restaurant because it wasn't working out. So do you feel like in Chicago, this is just a question that will just interest
sure.
me and my friend, but the small Italian joints that want to be real trendy and really upscale, they don't work because some areas like Chicago, and maybe this is the way in New York too, or in L.A., they like trendier Italian. Is there a trend to Chicago and New York and stuff where they like family style or like big plate Italian food? Because that's what they're traditional Italian.
Sure, traditional Italian,
absolutely.
Do you absolutely.
Find you see that in certain areas too, like with other stuff?
The short answer is yes.
Yeah.
There's a question or a statement actually behind the observation you just made, though.
Yeah.
I think, which is in first just a pure headline, right at 85% of the restaurants that open close.
Right. And you were telling me
they
that
fail.
Before the show.
Yeah.
85%
yeah.
of restaurants close.
So.
And is that within a certain year of time?
Usually within a two-year time frame.
Two-year time
the,
frame.
The traditional is 50% are out within a year, 85%
that's
are
rough.
Done within two. So back then to your question, because these ideas of let's do family style, or let's do Nepalese, or
yeah,
let's
sure.
whatever it might be, is they're all great ideas. The question becomes one or two or three things. One is, can I afford the land, first of all? What is the price of the location I want to go to? And if I'm in this particular neighborhood, does the neighborhood, can the neighborhood take one more family-style Italian restaurant? Or does the, or is, and if it can't, if there's already five or six, instead of going head-to-head with the other families, is there another kind of concept that I could do in this neighborhood?
Yeah.
The flip is, I love my family-style Italian so well, that's what I'm going to do. So now go find a location that concept will be successful in,
sure.
And it's unique.
Yeah, right. Because even with everyone says how many steakhouses we have in Chicago, they're spread out.
Absolutely.
Maestro's isn't across the street. Maestro's isn't across the street from Gibson's. Gibson's isn't by Gene and Giorgetti's.
Yep.
They have areas to themselves.
Yep.
I mean, Gibson's and Carmine's are across the street, but Carmine's is more of an Italian family joint.
Exactly, and each of those have their own unique nuance, for sure.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like it's when you open a Burger King across from a McDonald's.
Yep.
You're going to take business away from one or the other.
Yep. So from that real estate positioning idea, those are really the things to pay attention to.
So real estate so far, from what we are understanding here, is the most important first thing to figure out
when you're putting a restaurant together. It's certainly one of the big things.
Yeah.
Because it becomes...
you could kill yourself out of the gates.
I could be out of business before I ever even start.
Sure.
Because the lease just won't hold, or the cost of business won't support.
Okay, so let's say they get the location right. Now what do your services offer to people putting together a restaurant?
Well, so...
you figured out location, you figured out theme, what they're passionate about. You're talking about passion,
sure.
Tex-Mex. So we got a Tex-Mex and we got a location. What's next with your company?
Well, so I love your question. Let's back up slightly. We've been doing this work now with full success for over 30 years.
Yeah.
Right? With an 85% mortality rate, we've opened now over 1,600 brands around the United States. We've never had a loser.
Wow.
So that's not ego.
1,600 and 0.
Yeah. yeah. So this isn't, we're past the point of...
That's crazy.
It's kind of crazy, but it's also not ego. It's just data
at this
point.
It makes me wonder, though, are you selective about the places you pick? Will you say no to a place because you're like, there's no way we can save this?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that happens.
Absolutely. So, however, to your question, which is a great one, is what does it take to be successful?
Yeah.
Over this 30-year process, whether it's our clients or our concepts or it's anybody's, what we've seen is that there are really six things in place. So first and foremost is, what's my concept? Why am I in business? And I don't mean just family-style Italian or contemporary, American.
Like, for instance, where it tastes Chicago.
Right. Yeah.
They wanted to bring Chicago-themed food to L.A.
Yeah,
there
exactly.
You go.
So it may be some sort of fusion, whatever.
Sure.
Whatever my food and beverage mix is, and it could be a brat stand on the corner, it could be a taco stand, it could be fine dining. Whatever,
the food trucks, they're big in
or
L.A.
Or the trucks.
Sure.
Absolutely.
They're
huge actually
in
big
L.A.
in every major
Chicago's
city in the country.
Getting into them,
Austin's full of them.
Yeah,
oh,
Austin,
my God.
Right.
So first and foremost, not just what the concept is, but I like to actually ask my clients, what is it that your food is actually providing?
Yeah.
Right? So if we know what excellence is in our brand, can we define excellence? So that first and foremost piece is, do we know who we are?
Yeah.
What's our concept? What's our service? What's excellence? In performance of all realms. Second is all the financials. So have I figured out what my food cost is, my beverage cost, my labor cost, my rent, all the conversations we were having earlier about real estate? Because if any of those numbers are out of whack, the business is going to go down.
What do you tell people about the rent? Do you tell them you should be prepared to pay the rent in full every month without making a dollar or with losing money? Should there be a... how much of a mattress do you got to give yourself financially when it comes to a restaurant?
So that's a great question that comes out of that second piece, right?
Yeah.
First is, who are we? Second is, do we have our financials in place?
Right.
So the guideposts we use with working capital is, what's the money, I liked your point of, what's the money under the mattress?
Yeah,
right. And just our it's a rainy day, we've got trouble, the basement's flooded kind of stuff, we've got emergency money. Typically, that is at least 2 weeks of income, minimum, in the bank at all times. So gross sales. In a startup kind of a process, we like to think of 6 months of break-even money. So it might cost me $30,000. It might cost me $130,000 a month to stay in business. I want 6 months of that
cash
in the bank.
So if it's $30,000 a month, you want $180,000 in the bank.
Yep. And every dollar I've got less than that in the bank, I'm high risk.
High risk.
And the great majority of folks go out of business because they run out of money.
Have you ever seen people run out of money with their business that you were like, man, if they would have just planned better, they probably could have held it out?
Unfortunately, you just hit the nail on the head. That is sadly the most typical situation. Is it's a great idea, it's a great location, really nice people, and they haven't done the pre-work to get their numbers to. Because the important word in the phrase restaurant business is business.
Yeah.
And that's a place where Gordon Ramsay and I would agree 100%.
Yeah, sure.
Right, absolutely. Is like, have our ducks in a row, have our financials figured out, how much. So another killer is, well, I've seen restaurants. I was just in a place last week doing about $3 million in U.S. dollars a year. They had over $30,000 on the shelves in inventory, right? Instead of that $30,000, they could have had literally $7,000.
Sure.
Right? So the other $23,000 could have been in the bank ready for payroll or ready for a rainy day, whatever it might have been. But so an awful lot of people get hoodwinked into buying lots of product.
And that could be a loss, too, if they don't use that product.
Absolutely. Well, it's easier to get lost, to waste, to get stolen, unfortunately.
Sure.
Any of
you
those
remember,
things happen.
Food expires,
exactly.
It goes bad, you got to get rid of it.
Exactly. So waste, theft, all those things, much, much better. So there are actually systems, management systems, and ratios of turning a physical inventory or food inventory every week.
Yeah.
Right? Ideally, we want to see the whole inventory turn 1.5 times a week, every week.
Wow.
Right? So we're tracking food cost on a daily basis. Most companies track it by the month. We're tracking it daily.
So you'd rather have the distributors coming in twice a week
than
coming in once every 2 weeks because you overbuy or you buy too much.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And ideally even 3 times. One of the really fun parts of farm-to-table dining and short-haul, closer-in organic, what is called short-haul purchasing, is that we can actually, with those more modern concepts, get deliveries 4 or 5 times a week, which is a bookkeeping nightmare. However, it really, if I have a system for it, keeps my inventory low, my product fresh, my customers happier because the product's fresh, less waste, less theft.
How many times do you hear someone say, oh, they got fresh tomatoes from the market down the street?
Yeah.
And
that actually tastes like tomatoes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
what
people
a concept.
Love that. So this company is very successful. Were you keynote speaking at the beginning of the start of your company, or did that something you just ended up doing over time?
Keynoting and speaking in public was an outcome of our work.
Yeah.
I started speaking probably within the first year or two.
Did someone approach you about it, or was it an idea you had that you wanted to inspire people or help people?
At first, I was actually invited to come and speak. I hadn't even thought of it myself as a speaker. And as the years progressed more and more, it is one of the ways, like at the National Restaurant Show in Chicago or the California Show, Florida, wherever it might be, it's one of the ways I feel like we can give back to the community, because in an hour and a half conversation, we can give lots of good ideas to operators.
That's
so
great. That's great. So
thank you.
You find it, now when you do keynote speaking, is it usually at expos, like you were at the expo this week in L.A.? Mm-hmm. Is it usually at expos? Is it at, like, events like maybe there's Donald Trump's there and there's someone from this business and that business? Mm-hmm. Or is it a mix of all those things?
Well, first of all, just to be clear, I wasn't a speaker at the expo this week in California. So just to be clear about that.
They
had a handful of speakers, absolutely. Yeah. Linda Duke from Linda Duke Marketing was one of the speakers. She did a great job. There were a handful of others.
Okay.
I speak at the National Restaurant Show very often.
And that's
in other
Chicago,
estate shows.
You
that's
were
in Chicago,
about, right?
Uh-huh. But to your point, I speak oftentimes to large restaurant companies or resort companies. We'll speak with private events because we do a lot of leadership development within the restaurant business. So oftentimes our talks are not just about how to manage a restaurant, but how to lead people and how to inspire, how to motivate, and those kinds of things.
Now, when you're giving free advice with your keynote speaking to, well, they're paying you for it, but when you're giving advice to these large corporations and resort companies, how much advice do you give and how much are you like, you can hire me?
welcome to the dance, right?
You're right.
There you go.
Yeah?
Ideally, again, to me, one of the things that I love about public speaking is that it is actually an opportunity in an hour, in half an hour and a half, whatever the length of time is, to actually give away as much information as possible without, and the key piece is that it isn't a sales pitch. Look, these are things that we do at Rudy Mick. However, it isn't about Rudy Mick. It is about what we were talking about of doing our concept development and looking at the location we want to find. Just pay attention to this, right? Whether you hire us or not is irrelevant. What we want you to do is be successful, right? So ideally, here are three or four ideas that have really worked for our clients. Take those and run with them.
But you have found, though, through keynotes, I'm sure, that you've done such a good job with the keynote and your company speaks for itself that people do
absolutely
hire you.
Absolutely. Sure. There's not a doubt about it, and it's a great joy when that happens.
Have you ever turned down a big chain restaurant from working with them?
It's very rare I ever turn down anywhere.
Sure, sure. Money's money, and you're successful at fixing these restaurants and stuff. So,
but
like a big chain, if they came to you and you just saw, is there no project too big?
Well, no project is too big, that's for sure. We've actually worked on some global projects that were substantial. What is interesting, and with all kidding aside, we actually at this stage will interview our clients as much as they interview us, because the work we do is around human systems and human performance as much as it is the fiscal health of a company. And because we believe so much in principle-based, values-driven leadership where people are motivated and inspired to work, and we actually invest in them by training resolutely.
Yeah.
We're going to invest in training, which most restaurant companies don't do a lot of. It's really important that we make sure that the motivation of the client is matching ours, that we want to have happy people as well as happy bankers.
Right, right. So let me ask you then about, we were talking before, first of all, just take a quick little segue here to, we were talking about the definition of restaurateur. I thought that was really fascinating. Could you tell our audience what that really means?
Absolutely.
You said, I didn't think I knew and I didn't know, I don't think they'll know.
First of all, thanks for the invitation to offer this.
Yeah,
because
good.
To me, it's literally a life-changing concept. Is the actual root definition of restaurant is a place one goes to be restored.
Yeah.
If I look in an unabridged dictionary, deep into Wikipedia, it, a place I go to eat, a place I go to be fed is the third or fourth definition down. A place one goes to be restored is first. And restaurateur literally translates to restorer of soul. So if my servers can actually not just serve food, but serve it with the heart and care that says, this was prepared specially for you guys. Yeah, we're selling 500 other plates of this food, but this is for you, right? And all of a sudden, my job becomes more than just serving food. It's marrying the food and the wine, marrying the scotch we were talking about earlier with the potatoes au gratin or whatever it might be, some mixture of flavors that is just mind-blowing. That that creates inspiration,
yeah,
and it kicks. And oh, by the way, sales go up and bottom line profit rivets.
Yeah, that's true. So I thought it was interesting what you said about the human aspect of things, because the restaurant business is one of the few businesses we haven't figured out how to have computers make our food and give it to us yet.
Not yet.
So we need the human interaction. It's a big deal. Do you find that then this is a great industry to get into because of that?
I think it's an incredible industry. And oftentimes we talk about being a pass-through job, or it's you're getting a job as a burger flipper. I personally started out as a dishwasher, and by the time I was 23, I was offered a partnership in my first deal, you know,
wow,
just through sweat equity. I know all kinds of people that are still given those kinds of opportunities.
Yeah.
Right? And
I will say, the restaurant business is always giving opportunities.
Absolutely.
Always.
And one amazing thing is people are going to keep eating.
Yeah.
Right? So if we do our business right and serve and have fun doing it, for the right reasons, not only do we make money, but we can build careers. Absolutely.
With the incredibly high mortality rate, though,
yeah,
how do you, I mean, you obviously don't convince people to go in this business, but how should people feel about going into a business with that high mortality rate? Obviously you have to be so passionate about this that you would take that kind of risk, right?
Well, I think passion plays into it for sure. You have a lot of celebrities on your show. You have
sure
a lot of celebrities that are investors in restaurants and stuff.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that's really
interesting... We were talking about RPM, Juliana Rancic and Bill Rancic.
Exactly.
Sure.
So an awful lot of times investors will put money into a deal, into a restaurant, not necessarily because they're going to get big return on that investment.
Right.
Because of the restoral of soul.
My friend Phil Rosenthal does it. Phil puts his money into all these restaurants. Of course, he makes some money off it.
Yep.
But
yep,
it's because he loves food. And I just talked to Phil the other day, actually, and we were talking about Moza,
yep,
which he invested
yep
in, and
so,
an Umami. And look at it. He knows his food.
And there is something really cool, really sexy about, hey, I own a restaurant.
Yeah.
Right? When
sure
it works, it really works. So the thing to share with your audience, I think, is that if Rudy Mick can open 1,600 different concepts without a loser, is there risk? Absolutely. However, if the process is to do your homework in advance, do right things right, and mitigate the risk.
Yeah.
Right? Don't open a deal just because you love throwing a party on a Saturday
right
night. Right? Opening 300 parties, or a party 365 days a week,
yeah,
or a year, it's craziness, right? It's very different.
The only thing sexier than owning a restaurant is having the people that work at the restaurant cooking food in your own fire oven at the house that
absolutely
Phil Rosenthal has.
Absolutely. Totally cool.
Phil hasn't said this to me, but I go, Phil, you know, the pizza at your house is actually better than at Moza.
There you go. It goes back to the restoral of soul thing.
Right.
Right.
Oh, he loved it. That's what it's about for him, though.
Absolutely.
It's about, it brings him a joy.
Absolutely.
He, of course, if everybody loves Raymond, fame, and you know, he's a great TV
absolutely
writer and creator, but I think he loves food more than he loves his business.
Yeah.
I truly, truly think that.
Well,
you should see his face light up when he has good food. Just the happiest man.
Yeah, it's so amazing to sit across a table with friends, dear friends, and share food is mind-blowing. Back to the, just real quick, back to the investment thing.
Yeah, sure.
Right, and the risk. Why should I get in the business? Is if your listeners are passionate, it's a great business, and the risk can be mitigated. However, do your homework. There's a number on a financial statement. It's called a line item. There's a number for every cost there is in the business, just like running a shoe store or an
sure
automotive store. Do that work first and make sure that the passion pencils out to profit.
How different is the restaurant business from the bar business?
In my opinion, it's not very different at all. There would be some players that would say it's radically different. To me, it's not any different at all. It's the same deal.
So even if you were to open up like a dive bar, even
yep
like a small bar, it's not different in your mind,
nope,
really.
It's the same deal.
Yeah, you're just replacing the food with the booze in a way.
Yep.
And
one of the really cool things about the restaurant business is it's every business under every business there is, only it's what makes it different is the cycle time is radically fast. So a bar is just faster even than a restaurant. So I'm taking raw product, I'm creating research and development, I'm building production, I'm manufacturing a product, I'm accounting for the product, I'm selling the product, I've got servicing of the product, etc. And the bar business is just an even faster cycle time than food.
Yeah.
But we're doing all of those cycles of business under one roof thousands of times a day.
Sure.
It's a kick business, man.
Sure. And is there a less mortality rate in the bar business than
no.
in the restaurant business? It's the same?
It's just yeah, as it's, bad. Just as, it's just as horrific. And
you
know,
feel, I guess, like the simpleton in me says, well, it'd be cheaper to run a bar than a restaurant, right?
Oh, it's cheaper.
It is cheaper.
Yeah, it can be less expensive. However, here's the other slippery slope of our industry.
Yeah,
is the cash flow is running rampant. It's fast.
Yeah.
Right. There's money coming in and
you're
money going out.
You're not even sure
out.
Where you're at it.
Your
at
money.
Certain times.
There's money coming in and out so fast and. Think about this, we're actually, especially with the bar business,
yeah.
with wine and beer and liquor, we're actually dealing with legal drugs.
Yeah.
And so consequently, there's discipline that needs to come with that business as well. And yeah, I can shoot from the hip pretty well and make some dough. To really, really be successful, I better be tracking what I'm selling and where my product is that I'm
yeah.
not selling. So it's both.
Okay, so let me ask you then, back to the celebrity thing real
yeah,
quick.
Yeah, sure.
Phil Rosenthal, his name's not on any restaurants.
Right.
But like Juliana Rancic and Bill Rancic, they made very clear that RPM is their joint.
Yep.
How much value does a celebrity's name add as someone who owns a restaurant? Is it that big of a deal, or does it go back to what you were saying, where you have to have the passion, the food's got to be good, people still got to like it, right?
People still have to like it, absolutely, and I would be naive to say that having a celebrity participate in a deal isn't useful. It's so cool and so amazingly fun to have celebrity name and energy.
We were talking about Jimmy Buffett.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Right? I mean, to have somebody's
name. Sammy Hagar's
name,
got exactly, Cabo Wabo, right.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, right. We're here.
Right?
Yeah.
And there we, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely, that adds merit. And at the same time, my balance with that would be so too comes responsibility.
Yeah.
So if we get cocky or we get out of center, out of balance
Planet
with the
Hollywood.
Ego, we get so tragically hip with our ego that we think we're better than somebody else because of the celebrity.
Yeah.
That's a kiss of death.
And you've been doing this a long time, so is that what happened with the Planet Hollywood franchise, you think? Ego?
I'm not going to go there. I think
yeah.
that the celebrities that were involved there really actually had their heads and hearts in the right place, and
sure.
their bank accounts they put at high risk.
Oh, they loved it.
Absolutely.
They loved it. But did
Absolutely.
You feel like they were just doing... The food just was average. I mean, it had a good concept to a degree, you know, but the food just didn't work. I don't know what went wrong there.
It's just a gigantic concept that actually, if to your point, let's go back
yeah.
to the six steps of a McMethod,
yes.
is step number one was out of whack. They didn't really know who they were. They were so
right.
many things, right? Some people are going to say it was good. Some people are going to maybe say it's not. People's hearts were in the right place, but the due diligence really wasn't done as well, perhaps, as it could have. Just
yeah.
who are we and why...
That
or
was
all
always
players,
a fascinating,
you know?
Because I think in my lifetime, that is one of the few companies that was around for a long time
Absolutely.
And died.
Yeah,
It's not like they weren't successful at all.
Yeah.
There was a high
yeah.
level of success
yeah.
for a period. They
yeah.
were the Hard Rock Cafe in a way. Of
well, absolutely. And the other thing that you bring up is, and this may not be about that brand specifically, of
yeah.
of the concept of a themed restaurant, that the theme is
Rainforest
so tight.
Cafe.
Exactly. The theme is so resolute that it becomes immobile. I can't let the theme evolve. It just gets stuck.
Yeah.
And so there, if anything, that might be part of...
Well, Rainforest is kind of that way.
Yeah,
you can't,
absolutely.
It's immobile. You can't do much with it now.
Yeah.
What is the reason for success for major franchises around the world, especially, and this is a good question Caesar had, whose food's not that great? Like, how do these companies succeed? Like, I'll give you a great example. Golden Corral.
Yep.
How do they succeed? You're a Golden Corral, and you're out there on the market, and your food is just eh.
So what's interesting
is... But packed
is,
all the time.
No. Well, so the key word in our business is consistency.
Yeah.
And so even though you've defined that brand's food as less than good...
I think it's consistently eh.
Right.
But you're saying maybe some people think it's consistently ah.
Nice. I love that. Yes. I'll go to the ah place. So there's a market segment.
Yeah.
Right? Earlier you were talking about dive bars, right? Shot and beers, right? If a place can be a dump, but so radically fun and so radically so consistent that some segment can count on, I'm going to have this experience.
No, that's right. My dad, I think, has the worst taste in food, but he consistently goes to all the same places.
Yeah.
And you know what? The places he goes to are packed all the time. So it is what it is. I guess some people, we just have different tastes,
well,
all of us.
I think there's different tastes, and you're absolutely right. And so the covenant pieces are certainly food, decor, service, right? Or food and beverage,
sure.
Decor, service. Those would be the big three. More so of those three, though, it could still, again, be in a dump, but in a build-out, but the food is mind-blowing, or the bar is kick, or the service is so fun that I will be successful. Ideally, I've got all three of those pieces to place. Golden Corral, I would agree with you. Maybe it doesn't have all three, but it has all three.
It's packed.
It has all three to a huge segment of our population.
Sure.
So,
that makes me curious, though, about L.A. and Chicago and New York and Seattle and Portland and Miami. They all have neighborhoods. Chinatown.
Yep.
Little Tokyo.
Absolutely.
Koreatown. When you have all, like we were talking about how it hurts business to have two steakhouses across the street from each other. How do you have 10 Korean barbecues on the same block and they all stay in business? I mean, I barely see them go out of business in L.A.
Yep.
Like, and they've been around forever. So how does that work? Do you know how that works in those communities?
The communities are so tight. Again, think of the nuance of... So, and to your point, it could be the steakhouse business in Chicago. Same deal. They might not be side by side, but they're within a few blocks.
Yeah.
But the consistency of each one of those products is so resolutely there. And Koreatown in L.A. so hugely populated that the mass of people just is going to keep those places.
But, I mean,
going.
I go to Little Tokyo, and they got great food.
Yeah.
Great food. But you can get sushi from 30 places within a quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
Or like Thai Town, where it's literally Thai joint next to Thai joint next to Thai joint, Thai bakery, Thai joint, Thai joint.
Yep.
And it's like, man, 3, 4, 5, 6 Thai joints in this little mini mall, in this strip mall. How do they all stay open?
Sure.
And I guess they just do. Let me ask you, though, a lot of people have this perception that Los Angeles cuisine's no good. I disagree. A lot, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think Los Angeles, especially their ethnic cuisine, is outstanding.
Yeah.
What do you say to people that would assume that L.A. cuisine's no good?
I think L.A. is a great restaurant city.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely, and it's coming back even stronger with, I'll call it pizzazz. The food, though, has been amazing consistently.
Yeah.
And there's just so many concepts coming up here. That are great, and it's just going to keep getting better.
What's the restaurant Harrison Ford's kid has in Santa Monica? I can't remember the name of it.
And
is the coolest place in the world.
I've heard really good things, and I have yet to be there.
You
gotta
go.
I've got,
it's so good, and it's like weird shit that you'll never think would be any good, like fried pig's eyeballs, right? and you eat it, and you're like, they somehow made this fantastic. It's a great restaurant. That's when Nobu, of course, is huge out here. I think L.A. does high-end food really well, but I also feel like if you want a great cheap meal, you can get a great cheap meal in L.A. Thai food,
Absolutely.
Taste Chicago, you know, here
all
in
of
Taste,
the,
whatever.
Exactly. Going back
it's called Ford's Filling Station. Thank you,
thank
Caesar.
You very
yeah,
much.
That's good.
Thanks, Caesar.
It's in Culver City, yeah.
Thank you.
Great restaurant. Great.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, so this goes back to the multicultural element of Southern California and LA specifically. The ethnic food is mind-blowingly good. And here again, you know, back to the real estate question, the paradox that you're alluding to is how can there be five Thai restaurants in a row, five Korean restaurants in a row that are all kicking? Every one of them is so unique to themselves and consistently good that as opposed to being competition, that they actually build more sales by being a central draw.
Yeah.
Everybody comes into
makes
it, right?
Sense.
Not unlike a shopping mall.
No, that makes
place.
Sense. I mean, Koreatown's that way too, and Chinatown. They
exactly.
all have their specialties.
So there's
and stuff.
These funny kind of paradoxes of I want to stand out, and at the same time, in the right location, a group of restaurants together can actually add value. There's
yeah, that's
no doubt,
true. Like in
right?
Chinatown, Chicago, there's a couple dim sum places. And I'll be honest, me and my friends, we go to all of them.
Yeah.
We'll go to one Monday and go to another the other Monday. And so I guess, as long as you have really good food, people are going to come and the atmosphere is good. I do notice, though, when we talk about the atmosphere and restoring the soul, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to look like an RPM where it like wows you and it's all fancy
not at all.
And new. My
not
store,
at all.
My soul gets restored at this dim sum place called Triple Crown in Chicago, and it's a hole in the wall. It's a dive, and they got an aquarium in there that's the kitschiest, most awful thing.
Yeah.
So when you necessarily go into a restaurant to fix it, and let's say you would see something like that, is that something you would immediately fix, or are you worried about other things than the decor?
The decor, to me, more than anything, has to be clean.
Yeah.
Right? Unless the concept is filth or something, right?
Right.
Which I can't quite imagine.
It's a great concept.
There you
food.
Go. Yeah, there you go. Doesn't quite go. More, what's interesting, though, is the decor has nothing to do with the service attitude. And so what you're talking about is here's amazing food or amazing beverage, and the team, the staff that's serving it, somehow gets the spirit of this food so that it's not the experience of being on economy on an airplane of being asked, do I want a glass of water, right? I actually get served and serviced and supported for that restaurant.
That's most important.
Absolutely. And the decor package becomes then, I think, this is, again, a paradox. The decor package actually is the least relevant of the three, in my humble opinion, between food and beverage, service, and decor. Decor's the least relevant of the three.
I think Chinatown proves that.
Absolutely. And ironically, when restaurateurs get in trouble, the first thing they do is start working on their decor because they can hold on to it.
It's like in front of them.
I'll change the tablecloths.
Yeah.
I'll change the paint.
Yeah.
Right? I can hold on to it as opposed
to something
away.
Something you can do that day too. Run out to the hardware store, whatever.
Yep.
And it's a miracle fix. It's not the miracle fix.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you been to Connie and Ted's yet in West Hollywood?
Yeah.
What did you think of the service? Because I think that place is great, and I thought the service was terrible. It's a place, like, that's
they're
what I'm
really
saying, the food's
busy.
Fine, it's really busy, but it's like when you got bad service, I feel like I don't want to recommend it.
I think that this is the, without picking on any particular restaurant in the moment, my intuition is that this is the place that L.A. is missing across
service.
The board. The food is mind-blowing, right? Connie and Ted's, you just talked about. And a litany
great
of restaurants.
Food.
Incredible. What's missing is service and this sense of actual care and follow-up, right? Literally the science of the art of service.
You know how there's a million diners in L.A. and a million donut shops. And and everyone always goes, why do you go to Crave? They're a little pricier and whatever. The girls there are so nice.
Yeah.
They're so nice. Yep. And let's be honest, diners are diners. They're not that different from each other. So I'm going to choose the one that has the better service.
Yep.
Or they're better to me, even if it costs me $2-3 more.
Yep.
I think service is something that really does affect your business, especially in restaurants.
Absolutely.
I mean, it affects it in cars. I know people that don't get oil changes at certain places because of service, or they won't get their car worked on.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's just the business.
Exactly. And this goes back again to, well, what is my concept, and will my team even care?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, guess what? They will if I do.
Yeah.
And if we can actually slow down to figure out what excellence is in the service style we want, doesn't matter if we're swinging plates across the table or bringing a hotel tray,
right?
And silver service. It's irrelevant. The process is there a smile? Is there eye engagement? Is there knowledge of the food? Does somebody actually know how to crack open?
And this is something you impart in people.
Absolutely.
When you do the Mick method.
Absolutely.
And by the way, everyone can go to M-I-I-C-K, Mick.com,
uh-huh.
and they can learn about it
Thank
and everything.
You.
And of course, they can do that. Before, I know you got an engagement to go to soon. Before I let you go, I want to talk about the National Restaurant Expo in Chicago.
Okay. Sure.
Just explain what goes on there. Explain why this is the biggest restaurant expo. Give us the rundown of a week at the expo in Chicago.
So what happens is the National Restaurant Association holds an expo, food expo, that is 4 days long in Chicago, and it's the national show.
Is it open to the public, too?
It is open to the public. Anybody can actually attend. There is a fee to get in,
sure.
Typically. What ends up happening, though, is it becomes a national stage, like the California Expo is a regional or a California show. This is on a national stage. It's the second biggest convention in the world, actually. So typically there's 75 to 125,000 people.
What's
in
the
town.
Only bigger convention, do you know?
I think it is an equipment manufacturing
Something like
show.
That, right?
Yeah, exactly. I used to know. I apologize for not remembering.
So this is
At
the second
rate,
biggest
the
one in the world.
Second biggest show in the world. And what ends up happening is manufacturers of equipment are there, manufacturers of food service products, new ideas, new inventions, new marketing, new technology, kind of the latest, greatest, hippest, grooviest, baddest products are all on display there.
Yeah.
And all kinds of quick service food products to a litany of organic, sustainable stuff that is growing and just gigantically evolving part of our industry, which is exciting. All of those technologies and products are on display, and basically you're going to be in the throngs of about 75,000 people over 4 days, walking the floor aisle by aisle, looking at these products, talking to salesmen, saleswomen.
It's like the Comic-Con of food.
It is. It is that in a nutshell. You're far
if
pithier
you're a foodie,
than I.
If you love food, that's what to go. When
and
is
there,
that during
and
the
there,
year?
And
you
there,
know?
Yeah, it's usually in May.
It's
usually,
in May.
Yeah, usually okay. sometime between the week of the 18th and the 24th, somewhere in that.
Because you were at the Western Food Expo this week.
This week,
and
exactly.
this is a smaller event.
This is
it's
a smaller
not,
state
yeah.
show, exactly, or a regional
it's
show.
Regional,
exactly.
But this
exactly.
is national.
The
yeah.
national show, and it's actually international. Folks are going to come from all over the world to that expo. There's also lots of educational seminars. That are really terrific free information.
Yeah.
Once you get into the show. Hour and a half long seminars for mom and pop operators or kids that are in pro start wanting to get into the business.
You were saying maybe big chains are selling even franchises
Absolutely.
At these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. That's actually really fascinating to me.
Yeah. And there are also food boards like the Wisconsin Cheese Board and the American Beef Council. Those guys are there as well.
Is
showing
a franchise
products and
a safer
stuff.
Investment than opening your own restaurant?
A franchise is safer in many ways because at least the initial concept of the idea, recipes are built, equipment lists are put together,
marketing's built
some
in.
Marketing is
Would
built
agree,
in,
yeah.
absolutely. So So there is a there's an interesting opportunity with franchises that if I don't quite have the confidence to roll out my own idea, a franchise can be a good way to go. However, like buying a car or buying any piece of real estate, really pay attention and do the due diligence to do the right thing the right way, because there are better franchises that
we were talking about. One of my favorite franchises right now, which is Firehouse Subs, which is outstanding.
Yep.
And I think they do some of – first of all, their charity work's outstanding, but they do some of the best subs for any of those fast food sub places.
Yeah, they have a great product, and they have an incredible culture. Don Fox, who's the head of it, is sincerely committed.
It's a great
to,
company to check out,
absolutely.
Too. I agree. Well, Rudy, thank you so much for coming by. Mick.com, once again, is your website, M-I-I-C-K.com.
Thanks so much,
and,
Matt.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you came by. Oh, is there anything else that you need to plug or – Hello?
I think no plugs, just keep listening to the show because Matt kicks it.
Brother. Thanks, okay. brother. And Rudy Mick, thank you for joining me. The cast of A Teacher that was on earlier, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Matthew Aaron Show. Thank you very much.